Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Questions continue to swirl around Trump's presidential campaign. As the special prosecutor Robert Mueller continues to investigate, we know that many of the top people in the Trump campaign had close ties with Russians and communications with the Russians throughout the 2016 campaign. New information has recently come to light about another group hired by the Trump campaign to do research on voters. Key investigations by Channel 4 in England brought to light shocking information about a group known as Cambridge Analytica, who did investigations on voters in the United States and gave that information to the Trump campaign. We have with us today a representative of Channel 4 from England, Kylie Morris. Kylie Morris, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
We really appreciate the great investigative reporting being done by Channel 4. And for our listeners who may not know about it, you all did some investigative reporting and secret taping of this group, Cambridge Analytica. Would you please describe for our listeners what exactly Channel 4 did?
Sure. So I can just describe to you the background of the secret filming that was done. We had a number of members of our undercover team or our investigative team go undercover in order to meet with this group, Cambridge Analytica, who are a data analytics company. Our people posed as Sri Lankan nationals who were looking for assistance in political campaigning in Sri Lanka in upcoming elections. And the Cambridge Analytica executives met with us four times in kind of posh hotels in London and laid out the kind of business that they offered. Now, in a number of cases, they were simply describing the work that a data analytics company does. So they, are able to use their processes, use their information to kind of split up the population. They work on psychographics and personality traits and specific interests, and then they offer to kind of tailor micro-targeted messages to individual voters on the basis of that information. The terms that they used to describe doing that, they spoke about, playing on people's hopes and fears and talked about specifically about trying to, drop the bucket deeper down the well of whatever our fears might be, those unrealized fears that they might be able to speak to. They spoke also about their methodologies whereby, potentially they could send Ukrainian women to an opposition candidate's room and film that and put that on the internet, or they could offer bribes and film that and put that on the internet. They talked about working in a way that was untraceable and untrackable using, unnamed operatives in foreign countries and ghosting in and ghosting out of those places to do their work. So it was a fairly troubling description of the kind of business that they were pitching.
Right. So that's pretty amazing information you're sharing with our listeners here. And the first is, we know now that a lot of campaigns will do research about the psychographics of the voters. What are they thinking? What do they want to hear? And testing messages and all of that. But this group, Cambridge Analytica, has really taken this to a whole other level, and not only doing kind of the analysis of the voters, but as you're mentioning here, the trying to undermine opponents by sending women to them and filming them with the women, and really very underhanded, devious tactics. What tipped you off to Cambridge Analytica in the first place? Why did you send your investigative team in to do this secret recording of the interviews with the head of Cambridge Analytica?
Well, I think there were suspicions around the involvement of Cambridge Analytica. They had quite a talkative CEO, Alexander Nix, who's since been suspended, who is fairly boastful, I suppose, in his approach of what he could offer people. So I think he wasn't someone who had a low profile. And the fact that he was working, you know, that they were the data analytics company that worked on the digital campaign of the president, of course, you know, makes you immediately interested in them. Having said that, we were building on the work of some fantastic journalism done by the Guardian newspaper in the UK. They had reported quite early on about the fact that Facebook data was potentially being used by this small firm, Cambridge Analytica, and the way that Cambridge Analytica was using that in the campaign of Ted Cruz. So this was when Ted Cruz was trying to become the Republican nominee. At the same time, an amazing journalist called Carol Cadwallader, who works for The Observer, had her own sources of information too from inside the company that raised some real alarms about the way that they were operating.
Right, exactly. And I think a lot of our listeners are probably active on Facebook, as I think they have, a billion people a month using it. And this is another disturbing facet of this story, is that Facebook allowed the use of information of about 50 million Americans, that their private information, what they thought was private, was actually taken by a researcher, an academic who said he was using it for research, but that actually Cambridge Analytica got a hold of that information and used that surreptitiously obtained information about Facebook users for the Trump campaign. Is that right?
Well, the Cambridge Analytica deny that any of that data was used for the Trump campaign. However, it's clear that when they were in the business of building their psychographic profiles, which was when the company only began in kind of 2013, 2014, there was a British entity called SCL, which already existed, which had a more, I suppose, traditional background. You know, they had worked in military intelligence, and so they did that kind of stuff. Actually, one of the things that they talked to us about when we were doing our undercover reporting was, you know, that they knew people in MI5 and knew people in MI6 who could kind of do undercover work if that was required by clients. More broadly, once Cambridge Analytica got underway, they needed to try and deliver on the promises that they were making to people. They needed to scale up the amount of data that they were able to access to build more accurate psychographic profiles. This is when they had the relationship with Alexander Kogan, the Cambridge professor, and that relationship, which you very accurately described, led to data harvesting, as it's called, of 50 million Facebook profiles. The vast majority of those users have no clue that that information about them was scraped from Facebook, and that it was ultimately passed on to this political data firm, Cambridge Analytica. It's interesting, psychographics is a fairly new science. So certainly now, since the breaking of the Cambridge Analytica story, we've been hearing from people within the Trump campaign that they've been keen to downplay the role that Cambridge Analytica played. They are saying that they focus more on kind of traditional data science methods to kind of get results. And there are questions about how effective psychographics is and whether or not Cambridge Analytica could ever have delivered the kind of thing that it was promising. But I think, you know, it's important to remember that it, maybe the question is not so much, you know, did they actually affect the election? Did they actually, you know, create a situation whereby certain candidates were able to win because of their services? But, you know, what were they intending to do, and how did they conspire with other people to do that? And did they do it in a legal manner? I think that's a better set of questions to focus on.
Right, exactly. And I'm sure there's a lot of people who are Facebook users who are feeling betrayed now by both Facebook and by the academic who got the information and then passed it on, going, wait a minute, I didn't realize that I'm going to be exposed like this, and then that information possibly being used by a political campaign. So I'm very curious, too. Like, Cambridge Analytica first came to my attention back in November of 2016, right after Trump shocked America and the world by winning the presidential election. And I saw in Cambridge Analytica that they were involved both in the campaign of Donald Trump for president and also in the move in England to stop, for the Brexit vote, to get England out of the European Union. And I thought it was curious at the time that it was a company that was both involved in England on the Brexit vote and for the Trump campaign. And we now know a common thread there is that Russia, one of the big aims of Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, is to break up the European Union and to undermine the United States and the Western democracies so that Russia can become a great empire once again. And I wondered if there was any link then between Cambridge Analytica and the Russians, and if maybe some of their funding has come from Russia. Do you have any information on any ties with Russia in this Cambridge Analytica business?
The only information that we have is from a whistleblower, Christopher Wiley, who had spoken to Carol Cadwallader and spoke to us and the New York Times last week and kind of broke wide open the Facebook data scandal story. Now, he talked about the fact that Alexander Nix and Cambridge Analytica had made presentations to Lukoil, which, of course, is a kind of oil conglomerate, Russian oil conglomerate with very close ties to the Kremlin. He, at the time, expressed uncertainty as to why exactly Lukoil, this oil company, was interested in understanding kind of political profiling in the United States. And he expressed, some concerns at the time, apparently, about why they were really interested. Interestingly, the Parliamentary Select Committee, which is investigating fake news in the UK, heard testimony from Alexander Nix, and he was asked whether or not he'd done any business with Russia. And at the time, under oath, he said no. Now, for that reason, that's one of the number of reasons that the Select Committee is now recalling Alexander Nix. They'd like him to come back and give more evidence. Cambridge Analytica's response has been that this was Lukoil Turkey, not Lukoil Russia, and therefore he was accurate in his answer, as I understand it, and the reporting of it. So there are no kind of, as far as we know, I mean, there's a lot of work still to be done on this story, not only what role was played in the US, but also, what role it played in the Brexit vote that you mentioned. But, we know that SCL, the kind of parent company or the UK entity, was involved in over 200 elections over 25 years. So working in places like Kenya, for example, and Mexico. So I think every nation now is looking perhaps more closely, or at least every nation's journalist is looking more closely at the role that Cambridge Analytica might have played and what impact they might have had on national elections, wherever they are.
All right, exactly. And we have a rule here in the United States that there is no foreign money allowed to support candidates in the United States. And, we have some concern here now about with Cambridge Analytica having these kind of international connections and possibly the Russian connection, that it might have been a way for Russians to support the Trump campaign through Cambridge Analytica. And
I think we do know a little more about that in the sense that most of the money, so certainly the kind of money to build the U.S. entity Cambridge Analytica, came from Robert Mercer. Of course, the kind of Republican mega billionaire donor, Robert Mercer and Rebecca Mercer. Rebecca Mercer is still on the board of Cambridge Analytica. So, in fact, the kind of core funding for the company came from the Mercers. Steve Bannon was a vice president of the company at one stage. And those, I think the idea of the direct funding, at least for Cambridge Analytica, it's pretty clear that it was American money. However, you raise an interesting point because, of course, campaign regulations in the US also mean that foreigners shouldn't be in charge of campaigns. And I think people are asking, legitimate questions about whether or not Alexander Nix or another Cambridge Analytica executive might have been involved in playing a role that they weren't legally entitled to play. However, CA says that that's not the case, that they'd never played, that they never crossed that line.
Interesting. And do you know, or has your group done any research around the role of Cambridge Analytica in the Brexit vote, where it was a very close vote and it kind of, again, surprised and shocked the political world when the people in the UK voted to leave the European Union very narrowly, but that was where the vote came down. Is there any concern, given kind of the reverse on this, where the money for Cambridge Analytica comes from Robert Mercer, the Mercer family, and his daughter Rebecca, that was American money that was put to use in Cambridge Analytica that influenced your elections there in the United Kingdom? Is that a concern?
I mean, I think there is still a lot of work to be done on the engagement of Cambridge Analytica in the Brexit vote and what role they may have played. So I think that the jury is still out on that. I know that a lot of journalists, you know, at a lot of British newspapers and television networks are working on that at the moment. So I'm sure that more information will be coming out on that very shortly.
Very good. And you mentioned Steve Bannon. We know that Steve Bannon has been very close to Donald Trump for a while. He ran the Breitbart News, which is very kind of the alt-right home of the Nazis. And while he was running that, he was also, as you mentioned, vice president of this group, Cambridge Analytica. I just saw an interview on MSNBC this week with a man who worked for Steve Bannon at Breitbart News, and he said Steve Bannon tried to get him to also get involved with Cambridge Analytica while this fellow was working at Breitbart News, and the fellow decided not to do it, but he said it became clear to him in the interview around that Steve Bannon, while he was running Breitbart News, was also in command and control at Cambridge Analytica. Do you have any, and we know, of course, Steve Bannon went on to become a key advisor for Trump in his presidential campaign and also a top strategic advisor for Trump in his first year in the White House. Do you have any information or thoughts around Steve Bannon's connection to Cambridge Analytica?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Steve Bannon was actually speaking at a conference in New York yesterday and spoke to the issues of Cambridge Analytica. I mean, he talked about how, you know, he acknowledged the fact that he did help put the company together, but at the same time has distanced himself from this kind of Facebook mining question. He says that he never had anything to do with the dirty tricks of Cambridge Analytica, and at the same time said that, you know, Facebook data is for sale all over the world. So, you know, he was there. He was part of that company. The whistleblower presents a very different, you know, very different view on that. But he's saying that, you know, it was Steve Bannon's interest in kind of weaponizing his culture war that led them to seek more broadly Facebook data or more data profiles so they could build more accurate algorithms. But as I say, Steve Bannon's denying any kind of knowledge of any of that. So, yes, he was there, but we're still getting to the bottom of what his level of engagement was. I think you're talking about Kurt Bardella, the former Breitbart employee who left the company, he said in part because he was worried about the role that Steve Bannon was playing across a kind of multiplicity of political ventures, and he was uncomfortable with that. But he was certainly of the view that, you know, Bannon was very heavily engaged in the CA project.
Yes, right. And, well, we know, you know, Cambridge Analytica involved in psychographics. That's part of how the game is played now in politics, is getting this information about voters. So there's nothing in general illegal about that. But the great concerns about Cambridge Analytica come around, first, the way they're getting some of their data. As you talk about the data mining from Facebook, were, you know, up to 50 million people. Their information was scraped from Facebook without their, often without their knowledge, certainly without their consent, for being used in a political campaign, which now we get Mark Zuckerberg, the head of Facebook, is saying, well, no, that was against our rules and we didn't know that was happening. So, you know, there's concerns about the legality and the ethics around how Cambridge Analytica got the data. So that's number one. And number two, as you mentioned, is some of the really sleazy tactics Cambridge Analytica uses in campaign. I mean, you've got the head of Cambridge Analytica on tape in your underground investigation saying, well, you know, we send women to the opponents and film them, and you know, it's used to discredit them. So it was clear in that interview that this is kind of a tactic Cambridge Analytica is experienced with and has used in other occasions. Would you say those are kind of the two major problems with Cambridge Analytica, kind of the false methods used for mining the data and also the sleazy tactics they're using?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not only a problem for Cambridge Analytica, but it's a problem for all of us in you know, elections going forward, is the sense that there is a whole lot of data out there, personal data about voters, and if an approach is being taken, which is that, you know, facts don't matter so much as emotion does, and it's about playing to people's fears. You know, it doesn't have to be Cambridge Analytica. It could be another firm that's taking that view and another kind of candidate who's prepared to, you know, indulge in kind of dirty tricks to try and win elections. I think that's the thing to be concerned about, is the broader model and the broader implications. And I do think, I'm hopeful, I suppose, that one thing that might come out of all of this is that people who do use Facebook and people who do use other platforms are aware of their privacy settings and their rights for their own personal information to remain confidential, and use whatever tools they have at their means to make sure that, you know, they build the kind of firewalls that they need to and that they want to build. You know, Facebook is a great resource for people, you know, sharing information about one another, sharing information. You know, I have, my family lives in Australia, I live in the US, you know, and my husband's family is from the UK. So we have family all over the place, and it's an immensely useful tool to send, you know, pictures of the children and pictures of where you live, etc., and stay in touch. But at the same time, I suppose you have to be aware of what, you know, what other information is being gleaned about you, you know, from your Facebook likes, and what kind of a profile might be built about you. I don't think we all have to become paranoid and neurotic in the way that we engage online, but at the same time, I think it's useful to know what tools are at hand.
Right, and important to know that when we put information up on social media like Facebook, I guess we have to all assume now that anything that's ever posted could at some point become very widely public. So, you know, we have great issues about privacy in this age of incredible combination of great technology and really sleazy, dirty tricks in politics. This has been some great undercover reporting by Channel 4. I'm very impressed and very appreciative. For our listeners who may not yet have seen your undercover video where your reporters are interviewing the head of Cambridge Analytica and he's revealing all these underhanded tactics they use, how can our listeners see that video? Is that up on the internet somewhere?
It is. If you go to the Channel 4 News website, I mean, I realize every town in the U.S. has a Channel 4 News, but if you go to Channel 4 News UK, all our films, so I think there are four now, all of those films are up online to be viewed. They're all about kind of 16 minutes each, so it's a bit of an endeavor to get through them all, but it is amazing work, and I played a very small role in it. It was largely the work of our investigations team. And of course, you know, in collaboration with The Observer and The New York Times, and one, you know, former Cambridge Analytica employee who decided to speak out.
Right, that's great. And what was your role in this undercover reporting?
So I wasn't undercover, but I helped to build the film that came out of the undercover reporting when we tried to focus on what the U.S., you know, what role they'd played in the U.S. elections. I covered the elections here. I'm based here permanently. So I was able to work with our investigations team on sort of teasing out some detail.
Fantastic. Well, I appreciate that great work. And I would say this great reporting by Channel 4 UK is another indication of how absolutely vital it is to have independent media. And, you know, we're suffering right now in the United States where the president is regularly attacking the media and trying to undermine it so people won't pay attention to it. But really, an independent media is vital to the essence of an informed democracy. So thank you very much for that great work that you've done.
You're welcome. Thanks so much.
Yeah. And also, by the way, just as someone from the United States, appreciating you and other people in from the UK, we had Christopher Steele was the British spy who got a hold of or put together a lot of incredible research about the ties of Russia and Trump, and was very generous and thoughtful and courageous in sharing that information with our FBI. And I think this is a situation we're trying to handle in this country to deal with whatever happened between Trump and Russia and that whole election and trying to deal with the aftermath of it now. So we really appreciate all your great work. That's all the time we have. Kylie Morris, thank you so very much for being with us today and for your great reporting.
Anna, thank you.
Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. We Americans are facing big challenges these days. We have an authoritarian in the White House, a Congress controlled by Republicans, big money dominating our government for special interests, and a hostile foreign power, namely Russia, interfering in our elections. Many people are wondering, what happened? How did we get here? And what can we do about it? Here to help us figure this out today are two guests who are both leaders inside government and among progressive activists. First is Donna Edwards, a lawyer and community activist who served as a congresswoman from Maryland from 2008 to 2017, being the first African-American woman to represent Maryland in the United States Congress. Congresswoman Edwards is now a candidate for local office in Maryland. Is Congresswoman Edwards, who I knew before she ran for office and have great admiration for all that she's done. Congresswoman Donna Edwards, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you. It's great to be with you today.
Yes, and I'm so excited that you're running for office again, and I find it fascinating that you had kind of gotten into the high level of member of Congress, and now you're running to be county executive for Prince George's County in Maryland. So can you explain to our listeners, why are you running for that position?
Sure. I mean, you know, it's evidence that I believe that as progressives, we need to contest up and down the ballot every single elective office. And so when I came out of Congress, I thought about it for a little bit and decided that I really could make a contribution right here up where I live at the county executive level, doing things that are incredibly progressive in a county that really can take it. And so I'm really excited about that. And I think that when we, you know, run for local office on the ground where people live their lives and not just the, you know, the potholes and the trash pickup, but things like, are our schools working? What's our tax base? Are we, you know, growing our economy in a way that lifts everybody up? And these are things that I feel like I can do and use my experience from Congress, from the nonprofit and private sector, which I worked in for almost 30 years before coming to Congress. And so it really excites me. And I think if you look across the country, what you can see is that particularly progressive candidates are stepping up at every single level, because we realize that it's not just about federal office. It's not just about the House and the Senate in the White House. Those state houses matter. Those cities matter. The municipalities matter. And, of course, school boards and local government.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So I'm excited you're bringing your expertise and your experience and your wisdom and your judgment and your progressive values to have that influence at the local level. And I think you can get maybe way more done as the county executive at Prince George's than maybe you could if you were in this house right now, the U.S. House, which seems to have become a new level of dysfunctional. And you know, it was very interesting when we talked recently, you mentioned about spending 3 months traveling alone after you left Congress in areas that voted for Trump, including the Deep South. And I'd love for you to share with our listeners, what did you learn from talking to Trump voters? What do you see? Like, why did people vote for this guy?
Well, so, you know, after the election, I did. I got in my RV, and I started driving all across the country. And, in fact, by the time it was over, after 3.5 months on the road, I had logged in about 12,000 miles and 27 states. And, you know, when you stay in RV parks in particular, it's a really different culture, even from staying in places where people put up tents. And so I talked to people on a very human level about their hopes and dreams and aspirations. One of the things that I discovered, frankly, is that once you get past the layers of, you know, the group of folks who are racist and xenophobic and homophobic and sexist and all of those things, you actually find a group of people, I think, who voted for Donald Trump who are movable because they care about jobs and their communities and the direction of the country. They care about whether their kids are going to a good school and whether they're not living in their home and they are preparing for their retirement. And I believe that these are issues on which Democrats really can unite rural voters and urban voters for that new American future. And my travels along the road, and I, you know, look, I was in deep south and the Black Belt of Alabama through northern Louisiana across to the borders and Texas and Arizona. And I just learned so much from people about what connects us as human beings. And I think, again, you know, that segment of Trump voters who are all of those isms, you know, forget them. Let's talk about the group of people who really share hopes, dreams, and aspirations as Americans. And I think that we can unite around a truly progressive agenda that raises wages. A lot of people on the road talk to me about, you know, how they're just not even making enough to make a living. Some people were living in their RVs full time because they really couldn't afford to live in their homes anymore. They had lost their health care. And what was startling to me is the number of people I talked to who had signed up for Obamacare. And these are people who didn't like Obama, didn't vote for Obama, hated the Affordable Care Act when it was passed, but they signed up for it, and guess what? They liked it. And so I knew around, you know, January, February, when I was out on the road, that's a law that's here to stay and that it would be really difficult to get rid of it because people were signed up, they were getting health care for the first time, and they, you know, they felt safe and comfortable for themselves and their families.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, I love what you talk about, forgetting about the isms of, you know, the racism, the sexism, all the rest of it, and focus on our shared hopes and dreams. And I think you're really speaking to something about a common ground that's there, because we keep hearing the media tell us how polarized we are, and certainly we all see that even in our families, very strong differences of political views. But I agree with you. I think underlying that, we essentially all have the same hopes and dreams. We want good schools for our kids. We want to retire in dignity. We want to be able to live safely with, you know, without having crime or without toxins destroying our water. So I think you're really onto something about the common ground that's there.
Well, and you know what? We're not going to win over. I mean, I'm tired of trying to convince them. We're not going to win over the isms people. And so I'm not interested in that. But I am interested in how it is that we can have a conversation that unites concerns across rural and urban and suburban areas. It's really about that, you know, those common bounds. And, you know, I met, you know, people who had come, came from like completely different places than me. And you know what? We could sit across a picnic table out watching a sunset and actually talk about our families and about our children and about what we wanted to do in retirement and about the things that bug us and the things that don't. And most people didn't think about politics in the kind of partisan way that I had gotten used to in my service in Congress in Washington. Even people who came from, you know, deep into Trump country, it's not really what they think about every day. And they just want government to work for them. They want it to function for them on the things that they're concerned about. And so it was very exciting to me to do that and to be reminded about who we are.
Right. That's great. And you know, when you're talking, I'm reminded of the woman, Arlie Hochschild, who spent a long time traveling around Louisiana and checking in and having conversations with the Tea Party advocates, trying to understand, like, how can be people be voting against their own interests. And she wrote a book about it called Strangers in Their Own Land. And what she saw was, you know, similar to what you're doing, maybe a little bit different, that people felt that the government was kind of harassing them about maybe some local ordinance or some regulation about fishing or whatnot, but they were letting the big guys get away with polluting the water down there and that kind of a thing, and that people actually benefited from government, so they know that through the Medicaid or Medicare or Social Security, but they really felt that government had been kind of hijacked by the wealthy donors. And I'm hearing a very kind of similar assessment from you, that people really want the government to work for them, and they don't see anymore, like we took for granted from FDR and all the liberal programs that came in, that the Democrats stood for helping the low-income people versus the Republicans who were supporting the big business, but that in the past several decades, that line has blurred, and people don't necessarily see Democrats as helping them against big business. What do you think about that assessment?
Well, I mean, I think that there's something to that, because one of the you know, sort of messages that I heard consistently was, I voted for Donald Trump because he wasn't a Republican and he wasn't a Democrat. And it was almost like the pox on both your houses. And so they were lumping the Democratic Party in with the Republican Party because it was about money. And, you know, as I traveled through state parks and national parks, and I would, you know, park in these RV, you know, campgrounds, I would talk to people, and they loved the outdoors. They loved the idea that they could enjoy the mountains and the streams, and that there was clean water and fresh air. And they didn't totally connect that was because we had protected the air and the water from the Clean Water Act to the Clean Air Act. They didn't get that, you know, we had protected all of these beautiful, pristine spaces because there was a vision about a National Park Service that began up in the Badlands, you know. And so I think that as a Democrat, I feel like I have to do more, whether it's in my community or across the country, in helping people understand the positive role that government plays in their lives, and that they actually connect the benefits they see with the good that government does. I mean, keep in mind that we have had, you know, 30-plus years of a Republican Party that has been just bent on destroying the state and tearing down every part of government and saying that there's nothing that government can do that is right. That's a lot to push back against, but we have to start pushing because otherwise we run the risk of losing it all.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, we do see that people don't really want to hear so much about here's my 10-point plan and my agenda for what to do, that they don't actually believe anymore that government can do anything that's going to really help them. And what you're talking about is showing where government actually does help them and has a positive role in their life, that yes, we have protected the clean water. We are protecting the air. We've reclaimed water in many places. So to talk about the good that has done and that we can do more like that, that directly affects their daily lives, I think people need to see that in order to believe again that government can do anything that really helps working people.
And we have to talk in language that people understand. And so, you know, if we talk about, you know, keeping a stream, you know, clean so that somebody can go, you know, catch and release trout fishing, or, you know, the mountains so that you can actually see on a clear day miles and miles of, you know, of blue sky and, you know, and mountains, that actually is about climate change. But when we call it that, it's almost like we push aside a whole set, you know, set of folks. And so I think that we also have to learn the language that people are speaking and the way that they understand their world and their, you know, and their community and their environment. And we're not so good at that. And also we're, you know, pretty bad at lecturing people about how they should live their lives instead of living by demonstrating and by incorporating the ways in which people already do live. I mean, people are working incredibly hard. I mean, I met, you know, folks out on the road who are, you know, working not just one or two, but three jobs at minimum wage. And it's not like living in some places where, you know, they're talking about raising the wage to $15 an hour. It's about living in places where the wage is $7.35 an hour, and they're struggling. Mm-hmm. You know, people who, you know, actually got health care. I talked to one woman, you know, who is out in Hot Springs, Arkansas, and she had gotten health care for the first time, but she voted for Donald Trump. And she told me, she said, but I didn't think he meant it when he said he was going to take away my health care. She thought that she was still going to be able to keep it, and that's not why she voted for Donald Trump. Or, you know, the family who, you know, who is in Southern Illinois, whose son, I met a family whose son was a deputy sheriff, and he was shot in a small town serving a warrant. And they wanted to know that somebody was out there caring about their son. Well, those are, you know, American values. Of course we, you know, can identify with that. And of course, as Democrats, we're not enemies of law enforcement. We just want law enforcement to behave properly in all of our communities. And so I think being able to share some of those conversations, and for me to hear them more directly, and people would say to me, so funny, they would say things like, well, you're not really a politician. It's like, well, yeah, I am. No, but not like those other politicians. And, you know, we've become so divorced from our politics and our local politics. I mean, our members of Congress going out to the grocery store and buying a, you know, a carton of milk and some eggs so we know how much things cost, so we understand the lives that people are living and the struggles that they're enduring.
Right. That's wonderful. And are you, I know you're busy running for office right now, but are you going to write up anything of what you learned on the road? I mean, what you're saying is so rich and is really needed to help guide Democrats at the state and federal level this year in these important races happening.
Well, I kept an amazing diary in the time that I was on the road, and I was by myself, and so I had a lot of time. I did some coloring books, and I kept some notes, and I've begun to write up these stories, and I hope to compile it in a way that people can take it in. I also, in a couple of stretches of the road trip that I've done, took a couple of film crews with me, and so, you know, we're trying to make sure that those can get produced so that we can really tell the richness of the conversations that we had. And I'm not, you know, look, I'm not Pollyanna. I don't think that there aren't people out there who, you know, harbor resentments against people of color and people who are different because just because they do. But I do know that there is some richness in America that's, you know, evidence in our diversity in geography, our diversity in people, the diversity in states, that it's worth remembering and reminding ourselves.
Right, absolutely. Well, if someone wanted to help support this film, how would they get in touch with you, or who do they get in touch with to back it?
Well, I've been working through the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., but people can write to me. I, you know, see my email, and it's at donna@donnaforprincegeorges.org. And if you just look up Donna Edwards and Google me, you're gonna find me. And people have written to me on Facebook, and I've responded to them and, you know, contacted them directly. But, you know, I would love to have support for this project, because I think especially going into an election year, it's really important for us to have a deeper understanding of the electorate all across the country and to be able to connect the common concerns so that we're not constantly dividing the issues and interests of rural and urban communities, you know, around addiction and drug treatment, around jobs and, you know, the loss of manufacturing jobs, and all of these things really connect our communities. And so, you know, if somebody wants to contact me, you know, contact me on Facebook. I'm Donna F. Edwards on Twitter. I'm on all of the social media. It's not hard to find me, and I will definitely respond to you, because, you know, all we need is about $60,000 to finish this project, and it will be so rich to show the rest of the country and to share with some of my former colleagues in Congress as well.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And, you know, we have a number, obviously we have like 22,000 women now running for office at different levels, just like a real breakout year for women running at the local, state, and federal level. And if you had like 2 minutes to talk to them and kind of summarize and guide them, you know, what would you say to these candidates now based on your experience of having been in Congress, you're experiencing out there in the RV, talking to people about why they voted for Trump and what we need to do? What would you say to the candidates running right now this year? What do they need to do to win people over?
Well, I think, first of all, they have to be authentic, and they have to tell their own stories as a way to relate to the stories that they're hearing. And they have to be willing to listen, and listen to the critique, and listen to the skepticism, and to meet that head on. And I would say, you know, mostly you just have to be yourself. We all have stories and experiences. You know, oddly for me, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis about a year and a half ago. And so when I was on the road, I hadn't really talked about it very much. But then when I met people and they shared with me, you know, their healthcare experiences and, you know, challenges, I actually felt like I could share it with them too. And you know what? That was something that united us. And so we were concerned about the cost of prescription drugs and, you know, of seeking medical care and whether there was enough money going into, you know, into research. And so I would say, you know, to candidates out there, you know what? I've run races, and some of them I've won and some of them I've lost. And either way, you get knocked down, you just get right back up. But be your authentic self, because people will recognize in a heartbeat if you're not your true self.
Right. That's all excellent advice. And everything you were talking about earlier in this conversation was speaking to the issue. Like right now, the Democrats seem to speak very well to kind of maybe middle and upper class, college educated in the cities, which is where most people live in the cities, but really not speaking as effectively as need to in some of the lower income urban areas, and almost not at all to the rural or exurban areas, which feel completely bereft. Like, you know, they don't think the Democrats are speaking to them at all. Like you mentioned on our call the other day, the Democrats may say, yes, we want to work towards loan forgiveness for college students, which is very important, but then you have something like the over 70% of people who don't go to college. And what are we going to do to make sure that they get good training, maybe in a trade or some other way that they can get education and training that they can earn a living. So we need to be mindful of who we're actually talking about when we're talking about our program of action.
Well, I think that's right. And I mean, look, I believe in, you know, and working toward, you know, college loan forgiveness and things that are going to prepare people to go on to, you know, be successful in four-year institutions. But the fact is the overwhelming majority of Americans actually, you know, graduate high school and go right out into the economy or they go into a trade school. We have to be able to speak that language. And that's the language of rural America, but it's also the language of urban America. So if you want to ask, you know, why it is that we had so much trouble turning out the vote in cities like Philadelphia and, you know, down in cities in, like Raleigh in North Carolina and, you know, across in Milwaukee. Well, the reason is because we're speaking way over people's heads and their life experience, and we need to stop doing that. And that is, that doesn't mean that we abandon the idea that, you know, college for, should be a dream for those who want to go, but we have to recognize where people are living their lives, and they're not living at 30,000 feet. They're living 1 foot planted above the other on the ground. And I think until we do that, you know, we will continue to have a situation where, you know, our rural voters go with the other guys and our urban voters just go, they're not speaking to me, I'm just going to stay home. Well, we can't afford that, and especially in 2018, which is such an important year. And I would say, you know, the importance of the year isn't just about Congress. It's about all of those state legislatures that are going to redraw the lines for the districts in for after the 2020 census that are going to, that's going to have a deep impact on all of our lives for the next decade or two. So we have a lot at stake, and we can't get from here to there by speaking above and over people.
Exactly right. And one of the big concerns that comes up, and you know, people have a hard time getting past this one, but and most Americans see that there's such dramatic influence of the top 1% on our government, you know, the wealthy donors, the big business, and that's what's kind of setting the agenda in Congress and increasingly in the states. How did you see the influence of big money when you were in Congress, and what do you think we can do to address that major concern that really has a lot of people tuning out of politics because they feel powerless in the face of all that money?
Well, you just take one issue that impacts people so tremendously, and it is the major driver of the upward drive of healthcare costs, and that's prescription drugs. And there is almost not an office holder that the pharmaceutical industry does not contribute heavily to. And that keeps us from doing things like, you know, shooting for negotiating prescription drug prices so it lowers the prices for all of us. On the issue of gun violence, look, I actually, you know, when I was out, I had, you know, great experiences with people who are hunters and shooters and, you know, gamesmen. And that may not be for everyone, but those are not people who want to go out and get a handgun and use it in the commission of crime. We have to be able to distinguish those things as Democrats. And yet the National Rifle Association has really controlled the agenda, you know, has controlled the entire footprint of legislation, because I think that, you know, we have to have a language that allows us to communicate that we understand the difference between somebody who wants to illegally get a gun and go out and do great damage versus somebody who, you know, like my cousins, who want to go deer hunting.
Right. Exactly right, and well put. And I think also we're seeing an upsurge now. People are understanding that part of how you counter big money is with big action, that if all of us get involved and all of us vote, we really can make a difference. If you look at the recent elections in the Virginia state legislature, in New Jersey, even in Alabama for the Senate race, people got out, they organized, and they voted, and getting whole new blood in, new people who are not your typical the ranks kind of politicians, but, you know, regular people from the community running and winning. And that it seems like that's the best way to counter the big money is for all of us to vote, because why do politicians want the money? It's so that they can speak to the voters and win their elections. But if they see they need to actually be free of the big money for to get our votes, that's the way they're going to move, don't you think?
Well, I think so, and I think it also will create an environment for reform of the campaign finance system and to, you know, end this pervasive influence of money on our politics. But I think you're right. I mean, and we'll prove it in 2018. We've got, you know, so many candidates running at every single level, and they're organizing in their communities. And the power of organizing can sometimes beat money. And so I'm really looking forward to that. You can see the energy level across the country is just over the top. And, you know, I just hope that we can maintain that same energy level from now until November. I'm convinced that we can, because people really do want to grab a hold of their politics and pull it back so that it, you know, so that it's not so damaging as it has been. And, you know, and of course, you know, the president and his actions, I mean, he's a great motivator. But we can't just run against the president. We also have to stand for something.
Absolutely, and you've laid out a great program of action of what we stand for and our values. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have. You are a true inspiration. I'm thrilled you're running for office. I encourage all our listeners to check you out. You say social media or on the Google, Donna Edwards. Congresswoman Donna Edwards, thank you so very much for being with us and for your leadership for the country at our dark hour. Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.